Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
En este frasco ruge un silencio plebeyo, como de tropas mambisas. Presta salto que ha de huello. En este bulbo, humedad y amor bravío, Baraguana bello eterno, por lágrimas de dos ríos. En este envase, democracia sin alarde, orgullo para el honesto, vergüenza para el cobarde. En esta dosis, la virgencita de la caridad bendice al bravo David que enfrenta al rudo Goliath.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. I'm Norm Diamond, your host for today. Patricia Kohlberg is our multi-talented producer. In one of our segments this morning, Jan Hocken asks how we grow and sustain political movements. She's referring to the Sunrise Youth environmental movement, but the same question applies to revolutions. Tomorrow is the Cuban national holiday. We celebrate it by looking at the challenge of transmitting revolutionary spirit to subsequent generations. And thus, we have a theme for today's Old Mole: how to maintain and build our efforts to transform the world. Lessons from abroad, not all of them positive, could even teach us something here at home. Our introductory music this morning was a mashup of the Old Mole theme with a song from the contemporary Cuban group Buena Fe, literally goodwill, as in taking action with goodwill or in good faith. We'll hear more from Buena Fe and from an older Cuban favorite, Silvio Rodriguez, as the show proceeds. To begin the program, Bill Resnick interviews Gerald Epstein, professor of economics at UMass Amherst, on the real causes of the current inflation and what action should be taken to halt it. Needless to say, if the Federal Reserve is misdiagnosing the problem, their cures are not going to help. But why this misdiagnosis? In whose interest is it? Then Jan will talk with three organizers from Sunrise PDX's Youth versus ODOT campaign. Ada Crandall, Calliope Ruskin, and Liam Castles discuss how they chose their target and how and why they relate to local politicians. Finally, our continuing series, Another World is Possible, looks critically at contemporary Cuba. I ask whether we can be supportive without relinquishing our own judgment about the consequences of leadership policies. How are we to understand last year's protests in Cuba and the choices leadership has made in response? Before delving into the program, I want to alert you to a Medicare for All rally this coming Saturday, July 30th, at noon in downtown Portland at Shemansky Park. There'll be music, tabling, speakers, even a march ahead, all to celebrate Medicare's 57th birthday and to advocate that everybody should receive comprehensive health care. As we turn to Bill Resnick and Gerald Epstein, listen to the spoken word poem with which Silvio Rodriguez begins his song, Sueño con Serpientes, I Dream About Serpents.
Hay hombres que luchan un día y son buenos. Hay otros que luchan un año y son mejores. Hay quienes luchan muchos años y son muy buenos. Pero hay los que luchan toda la vida. Esos son los imprescindibles. Bertolt Brecht.
There are people who struggle for a day and are good. There are others who struggle for a year and are better. There are those who struggle for many years and are very good. But there are those who struggle their entire lives. Those are the indispensable ones. He's quoting from Bertolt Brecht. And now, Bill Resnick with Gerald Epstein on inflation.
Gerald Epstein, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jerry Epstein is a very busy left economist, has done quite a few books, mostly for experts, and he also speaks, writes, engages in popular organizing, was interviewed for a recent article, Hiking Interest Rates Protects Financial Assets of the 1% at Workers' Expense. He teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where he's founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute, and he's a longtime staff economist for the Center for Popular Economics. Both do a great job of analysis and developing economic alternatives that support working people and increase their power. So, Jerry Epstein, inflation is the economic topic of the day. The Biden administration is doing several things trying to control today's inflation. But the main thing that impacts everybody, though in different ways, it's urging the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates, which they have done and appear committed to continuing. That's to stop inflation. My sense is, reading you and others, my sense is that that's the wrong cure in any circumstances, and especially now for today's inflation. Tell us why and what might be done today, and then we can discuss why raising interest rates has become the all-purpose solution.
Yes, inflation has become a huge political issue, and it is harming the livelihoods of many Americans. And so the government is trying to grapple with this, partly because it's so politically costly for the Biden administration. The Fed, our central bank, has as one of its main targets, mandates, is to keep prices stable. And it feels particularly focused on trying to make sure that inflation is stable. The problem is, raising interest rates is the wrong tool for this kind of inflation. And if it raises interest rates, it threatens driving the economy into recession, raising unemployment, and harming the very people that it's supposedly trying to help. The way I teach this to my students is I tell them this. The libertarian economist Milton Friedman always said, inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. And he always thought that that meant that the problem was that the Federal Reserve created too much money. But we have to think about the second half of that sentence, too few goods. In this case, the problem is that there are too few goods being produced. So the Federal Reserve, when it raises interest rates, it's lowering the money supply, raising the cost of credit, reducing demand, but it's not doing anything to increase the amount and availability of the goods that we need. Now, when the Fed raises interest rates, first of all, it's worsening inflation because it raises the price of credit. You know, Wright Patman, who was a Democratic populist congressperson from Texas, always used to say, if the Fed raises interest rates, that's going to raise the cost of doing business, and that's going to worsen inflation. And in the first instance, he has a point. So how does raising interest rates possibly lower inflation? Well, it lowers inflation by making it too expensive to buy houses, to buy products, and leads to higher unemployment. And it really tries to lower inflation by restricting the power of workers to increase their wages and get decent working conditions. And by doing that, if it's the workers who are hurting from too high prices, it's actually hurting the workers rather than helping them. Now, why does the Fed do this? Well, to some extent, it's when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so the main tool that the Federal Reserve has is interest rates. And so it says, look, we have this inflation. We have this one tool. Let's raise interest rates. They don't take into account the fact that the problem of inflation is not too much demand, but not enough supply. And raising interest rates is just going to reduce supply even more. Worse, it takes a really long time for raising interest rates to lower demand. And you have to raise interest rates by a lot. Economic estimates are that you have to raise interest rates by 2 or 3 or even 4% to reduce inflation by 3 or 4% under normal circumstances. It would be even more now because this is mostly too few goods, that is, supply-side problems. So the Federal Reserve has the wrong tool it's using, and it has the wrong diagnosis of what the problem is. Now, the way it's doing it, I tell my students, you know, don't let the cure be worse than the disease. So by raising interest rates, making it harder for companies to borrow and produce more and increasing the cost of building new houses and so forth and throwing people out of work, you're making a cure that's worse than the disease. It's not the way to go. So I say to the Fed, don't just do something, sit there. That is, don't rush into these massive increases in interest rates that aren't going to work or going to be very costly if they do. And let's think about what else can be done to control this big increase in the cost of living. So what can be done? Well, first of all, we have to do something because there are millions of Americans who are seeing that the cost of necessities is going up dramatically, and it's really hurting them. The biggest increase is in energy prices have gone up 40% over the last year. Food prices have gone up 10 to 12%. Housing prices have gone up significantly and so forth. Many of these things, especially for working class and poorer people, are necessities, and they are creating lots of problems for people. So what can the government do to help these families? Well, first of all, there's been a bill put into Congress by Jamal Bowman, Democratic congressperson from New York, Ro Khanna, Democratic congressman from California, and Sheldon Whitehouse, Democratic senator from Rhode Island. And this bill says, look, the oil companies are making out like bandits. Their profits are going up tremendously. This is, in fact, a general problem right now. We're getting this massive profit push from these companies that are raising their prices as a result of this inflation. So they've estimated that these oil companies have gotten $90 billion in windfall profits. So what they're proposing is to tax some or all of that and just give it back to Americans or give it back to people in the United States to help defray the costs of their higher oil costs. This is a general kind of principle that ought to be followed. The government should increase its food support programs to give food subsidies to poor and working class people who are particularly harmed by this. It should increase rent subsidies to help the people who need help with rent. And it should do things to try to increase the supply side of products. So, for example, one of the problems we have is that the labor supply, there's a lot of job ads out there for workers and a lot of people who can't go out to work. Part of the problem is childcare. Childcare is so expensive that a lot of people need to stay home to take care of their children because the wages they're getting from their jobs aren't sufficient to cover the cost of childcare, even if they can find it. And sometimes they can't even find it. So the government should subsidize childcare and help create more opportunities for childcare. That's number one. Number two, there are supply problems at the delivery of products. So we don't have enough truckers to move all the products around. And a big problem there is trucking jobs that don't pay high enough wages. So trucking wages need to go up to help clear out this supply chain mess. So there are a number of things like that where the government needs to subsidize people so they can get over this short-term to medium-term problem and do things to make sure that there's more supply in the economy of the things that we really need. Now, the Federal Reserve, going back to where we started, actually has two tools of monetary policy. One is interest rates, but the second is buying financial assets. And the Federal Reserve has been buying trillions of dollars of financial assets, first during the great financial crisis of 2008-2009, and then again during the COVID crisis starting in March 2020. But what they've mostly been doing is buying financial assets from wealthy people, from banks and other financial services companies, essentially bailing out the financial system to the tune of $4 to $6 trillion. So what they could be doing instead is buying financial assets of companies that are trying to provide more or cooperatives, workers' cooperatives, communities, public banks, and so forth that are trying to create more food banks, more public transportation in cities, more childcare, and so forth. The Federal Reserve could be buying assets that would allow these kinds of supply things that I just talked about to increase. But instead, they're still just buying financial assets of the wealthy and raising interest rates on everybody else.
That was a really comprehensive look at the pressure on all working people and the need to find other ways of dealing with the supply side problem. Let me do a station ID first and reintroduction. I'm Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Talking to Jerry Epstein. He teaches economics at UMass Amherst, also co-directs the Political Economy Research Institute, and is a longtime staff economist for the Center for Popular Economics. We'll be talking about that at the end of the interview, the center. We've been discussing how raising interest rates to stop inflation greatly benefits the rich, which particularly those with precarious marginal incomes. Jerry, One issue that came to me reading your stuff and hearing you, my sense is that supply is not so much the cause, but it's an enabling condition. And what it enables is the corporations at almost every level of the economic system can raise their prices, and they raise their prices somewhat beyond the increased cost that they have to incur. And it seems to me that's the key to it, is capitalist behavior and corporate behavior. Like, let's say in housing, housing prices have gone up so much in the last several years, not because the cost to the owners, and there are increased costs in construction because many of the companies beneath them, the material suppliers, have raised their prices. We're sort of sitting in a position where so many companies have really kind of monopoly control. They're not really having to compete with anybody. So they raise prices to where they can make a maximum income. At least that's my hypothesis.
Yes, that's an excellent point. A study by Servaz Storm and some people at the Economic Policy Institute call this profit push inflation. So they've shown that oligopolistic or monopoly power among corporations have allowed them to really increase their profit margins during this inflation, and that perhaps as much as 30% of the increase in prices or 30% of the inflation can be explained by this, what you just described, which they call profit push inflation. So, you know, if there's inflation going up a lot and people are blaming the Fed or people are blaming Biden or people are blaming the oil companies, well, why don't these companies get in on the game and just raise their prices even if the costs don't warrant it, because everybody's looking the other way. So I think what you said is this inflation partly enabling more inflation through these monopolistic practices is certainly true. There are, though, real supply constraints as well. And so I would say that both of those things are going on. There are a couple of points that I meant to make earlier and just want to quickly make. You asked, you know, why is the Fed so concerned about inflation? And you mentioned in your what you just said, the part of it is they want to protect the wealth of the wealthy and the bankers. And that's certainly true, that people who lend money and have a lot of financial assets, they, as a rule, do not like inflation because that erodes the real purchasing power of their wealth. And so the Fed has always been biased towards the banks and the wealthy people. So that's part of the reason why they put so much focus on inflation and not enough on employment. A second point, and this may relate to what we're going to talk about next, is that the Biden approach on oil prices seems to be completely wrong. He's trying to increase the more oil production, more fossil fuel production in order to drive down fossil fuel prices. But if we want to think really about a solution to this inflation, you know, we really don't want to forget the children. We don't want to forget the grandchildren. That is, we need to restrict the use of fossil fuels. We need high prices for fossil fuels so that we can make this transition to green energy. So rather than seeing this as a serious problem, we should see it as an opportunity. That is, an opportunity to create the incentives to have people move to electric vehicles, carpooling, public transportation, and so forth, and not try to get more fossil fuel production, more oil. Now, of course, there has to be a transition. That is, people are dependent on oil and gas, and it's very harmful for a lot of people who are so dependent. So once again, that's why this windfall profit tax is a good idea, to tax these profits of the oil companies, subsidize people so that they can afford to get to work and do what they need to do. But let's keep the price of oil high.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the climate. For quite a while, you know, I read some economic literature, I'm sort of a dilettante, and often I see the argument, it's a sort of a naked argument from the left, but the right engages in this claim too, that whatever the policy they're opposed to interferes with or reduces growth and gross domestic products, as if, in fact, the GDP, the gross domestic product, or just the growth figures, I guess that's the major one, is in itself a good thing. But in terms of the climate, I have always liked the line from David Suzuki, who's a very well known, very popular. Now he's aged out, but in his day, he drew huge crowds in his tours. He was really tireless, trying to talk about environmental destruction long before I even think Rachel Carson. Anyway, David Suzuki would say, growth is the creed of the cancer cell. Now, he said exponential growth is, but now we can't just rely on growth for well-being, because so much growth leads to so much increases in greenhouse gas pollution, which will, in fact, ultimately lead to a planet that's uninhabitable for humans or only for small bands. It seems to me, in a couple of sentences, even when they say growth, it should be said in a sort of in a context where it's good growth, and what you were suggesting, rather than just this sort of destructive increase in production and consumption for the aimless and always consuming more wealthy.
I completely agree with you. Growth, as is traditionally used by economists, is really obsolete now. And some economists have recognized that for a while. But what we need to make sure is that there is an expansion of opportunities for sustainable life on the planet, and those who have way too much and are harming the planet through their overconsumption need to cut back, and we need to leave more room in the global budget, carbon budget, if you will, for those who are impoverished and need to have, you know, the basics. So when thinking about dealing with a economic problem like inflation, as we were just talking about, what's clear is you don't solve that problem by worsening the existential crisis that we have of global climate change. You don't try to solve that problem by expand the use of fossil fuels. You take the opportunity to reduce the use of fossil fuels. So it matters a lot that we don't think about growth as is traditionally defined by economists. We can think more along the lines of economist and sociologist Juliette Shore when she talks about true wealth, you know, true wealth being the social connections and a standard of living and leisure time and good health and community safety and so forth, not in terms of overconsumptions of goods and overwork. But of course, we have to recognize that there are many parts of the planet, many people, millions, billions of people on the planet who don't even have the basics. So we have to make this transition to a green economy. And as my colleague Bob Poland has written so eloquently about this, there'll need to be expansion of certain industries, green industries, retrofitting of buildings and so forth. While at the same time, there will be contraction of other industries, fossil fuels and so forth. And so whether the economy keeps growing or not in a traditional sense isn't really an issue. It's whether it expands these sustainable production, distributes it to people who need it, and creates true wealth for everybody.
Jerry Epstein teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He doesn't teach the dismal variety, however. Jerry, tell us about the Center for Popular Economics and how people can learn about their books and other stuff.
The Center for Popular Economics has been teaching activists and just regular people about economics as if people mattered since 1974, CPE, Center for Popular Economics, and it offers workshops and writes publications. You can find them on the web. Just Google Center for Popular Economics, CPE, and they're located in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Thanks a lot for talking to us, Jerry Epstein.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Bill and Gerald Epstein. Jen Hocken has been following the young organizers, part of the Sunrise Environmental Movement. She's had them on the Old Mole before and promises to again. Here she talks with Ada Crandall, Calliope Ruskin, and Liam Castles.
Welcome to KABU, Ada Crandall, Calliope Ruskin, and Liam Castles.
Thank you for having us.
Well, you're all organizers with the Youth Climate Movement, and we're part of the Portland Youth Climate Strike this past month, which was an incredibly vibrant day of creative events. One of the organizing ideas centered on targeting local villains in the climate emergency. The Oregon Department of Transportation, or ODOT, was among those villains. Well, let's start with why you targeted that agency. and then how you're pursuing activism now and following through on that.
Yeah, so I think to a lot of people, the Oregon Department of Transportation would seem like an unlikely target for the youth climate movement, but people don't realize that 40% of our state's reported carbon emissions come from transportation. And those emissions aren't coming from things like people biking and walking, they're coming from freeway expansion, which is what ODOT continues to prioritize and is why they are a target of the climate movement here in Oregon.
We'll get into some of the proposed plans of ODOT, but let's first talk about another creative action of the youth that day, which centered on pledges signed by politicians to address the climate crisis. Can you say a bit about those pledges and how you and some of the other groups are holding politicians accountable?
Yes, the idea was to get politicians to make a commitment, a written commitment, to an end to fossil fuel infrastructure expansion. And we had a bunch of politicians come and sign the pledge that day and put their names on that document. And going forward, we hope to make that something that more and more politicians will sign on to and become part of and take to heart and truly use going forward. We're really just starting out when it comes to holding them accountable.
We're all familiar with political pledges, aren't we? I could line my walls with wallpaper of politician pledges, but it's all about the follow-up. And I think the creative strategies that you're pursuing in not only creating a form of street theater out of the pledges, but also in the follow-up and how you recognize too the pressures politicians, even progressive politicians, are under as they try to fulfill those pledges. But let's first turn to the point you made about the ODOT plans for freeway expansion. As I understand, there are two proposals, right? And a series of plans that have unfolded. Calliope, can you address that, the plans?
Yeah, basically the main two that we're focusing on are the interstate bridge replacement, which is a joint work between, I believe, like the Vancouver and Washington government agencies and the Oregon and Portland governments. Yeah.
And then the other main project that we've been targeting is the Rose Quarter Freeway expansion, which is a proposal to add more lanes to I-5 that essentially would cut into the hillside that Harriet Tubman Middle School sits on and would increase pollution in the surrounding neighborhood. Those are the two that we've been most focused on, but they are just two of many, many proposed expansions around the state.
Now, the proposal around the Rose Quarter has a complicated history with different positions on it, including in leadership in the Black community. Can you help unpack some of that history and the competing claims and interests around the Rose Quarter plans?
Yeah, so the original construction of the Interstate 5 freeway cut through the historically Black Albina neighborhood and displaced thousands of residents. And the current plan includes, in addition to adding lanes, it includes capping the freeway, which would reconnect the two parts of the neighborhood that were previously divided. And that's something that community groups are really getting behind. And we, as climate advocates, fully support the caps. That's such an important step to reconnecting the neighborhood and to healing these historic harms that have been caused to Black communities in Portland. And we also know that it would be a much better project to do the caps without expanding the freeway, without increasing pollution.
So is this all one big package that's being pushed through, giving something for everybody as a strategy? Or How does that work in your understanding of the politics of it?
For the I-5 Rose Quarter Freeway Expansion Project or the Interstate Bridge Replacement Project?
The Rose Quarter Project.
My understanding is that ODOT is trying to put a lot of different pieces together to make this project happen. And they can't really do anything but try to give everyone something to try to make it work. And with both projects, frankly, that's really all they're doing, is they have this project that they really want to push through that is very obviously bad for the environment and goes against so many of the things that they often say are their principles. And to try to make it look good, they'll add on all the things that work for every different group, whether it's, you know, unions or the neighborhood or the city. As a whole, that doesn't actually fix the project. It just makes them look better politically, and makes it more likely that the project is going to get passed.
And what specifically is politically regressive, or from a climate perspective, regressive about each of those proposals?
For them in particular, or?
I understand that the problem you focused on is expansion of freeway and lanes on the freeways. Is that an issue in both of these, with both of these proposals, Calliope?
Yeah, it is. Basically, the way that freeway expansions work when contributing to climate emissions is because of something called induced demand, which is basically the idea, it's very similar to like economics, but basically it's the idea that more lanes, the more cars. So the more cars, the more pollution. And basically the more lanes you add, there will be more pollution, that it is entirely inevitable.
And that's been shown time and time again, whereas, you know, 5-10 years down the road, as soon as they add freeways, in Portland, in LA, in every city across the US and across the world, when you add more lanes, you get more cars later. That's just how it works.
Isn't one argument that is introduced to counter that people use a lot of, there's a lot of pollution from stalled cars that aren't moving through an area fast enough?
Yes. And the data points that ODOT is using to make that argument currently are based on a reality where induced demand doesn't exist. So at one point, they were actually saying that expanding the Rose Quarter freeway would reduce emissions, but that's because they hadn't figured in induced demand. And the idea that expanding the freeway won't actually reduce congestion, which means that it won't actually reduce pollution. It will, in fact, increase pollution because there will be more vehicles driving.
Just another data point, what your baseline is, or your assumptions about transportation and the needs of the transportation sector, and what kind of vision of moving about in the world we adopt in the climate movement. Can any of you speak to that? What your vision of the alternative, an alternative progressive approach to transportation, and what we should demand of transportation agencies?
So to me, part of achieving climate justice is transforming our transportation system to not center cars and instead center people. So center moving people instead of moving vehicles, which means investing in biking and walking infrastructure and public transportation, things that will actually serve our communities instead of serving this status quo that tells us that we need to all be driving around in our polluting cars, because
whether electric or not.
Yeah. This idea that cars are a necessity has led us down a deadly path to climate destruction. And even when politicians make the point about like, oh, vehicles will be electric, like it's ultimately the same impact. It's still like car infrastructure and roads are destroying our cities, because even without the factor of the climate crisis, it's like we've created a world where it's hard in some places to even go outside because there's not like natural areas. There's giant roads and traffic. And that's not a world that people want to live in. And that's not a world that we want to leave for future generations.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to look at the history of transformations in the transportation sector. I remember when I was a little girl, Eisenhower proposed, you know, and it was one of the big federal projects with putting in the I-5 highway system, which transformed the country. And I think it is not as though we have not had historical periods where massive resources have been invested in transforming the transportation system, the role of the airlines, and the massive subsidies of airports. So this is both a local issue, but is there also a broader vision of that that's part of the Green New Deal around how we should be transforming the transportation system.
I think so. I think that goes back to what Ada said about centering it all around people and moving people and not moving vehicles. And that, you know, that applies to Portland, that applies to Oregon, that applies to the United States, and that applies to the world, right? Our priority should not be moving, you know, 2 tons of metal per person on the road, because it's just so unbelievably inefficient. And if we can make it something that is public, that everyone can use, that is safe, that is equitable, then I think we have a really good chance of making our world better as a collective.
Before we close, I'd like to get back to this point we took up at the start of holding of the pledges, politicians making pledges and following through on those pledges. I know with the recent vote on these ODOT plans, the Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has been an important ally for progressives, voted yes, but she added a caveat and saying it's limited to the environmental evaluation and preliminary engineering phase. In 2 years, the project will need to come back to City Council to make the case that ODOT has kept its promises and deserves to proceed to construction. So there's also pledge and promises there from ODOT. Does that make a difference in terms of how you weigh maybe a disappointment that Commissioner Hardesty voted to approve these projects, but how do you assess her vote on that?
I think it's really disappointing to see a leader like Commissioner Hardesty vote to move forward with the bridge replacement project, because she has absolutely been and still is a very strong ally of the youth climate movement. And I think there are a lot of very complicated politics all tied up in the interstate bridge replacement. And so I don't think it's a reason to like think, oh, Commissioner Hardesty is not a climate leader anymore. But I think looking at it at this broader picture of all of the many, many regional elected leaders who voted this past week or the week that we're recording this to support moving forward with the current project, a lot of them said that thing about like, oh, this is just the first step and there will be other opportunities to critique things in the future. And like, to me, that's an excuse. That's a sort of like, we're putting it off until later and we're not going to deal with it right now. When in reality, like this vote could have been those regional government entities' best chance to do what is right and to stop this project from being a freeway expansion. And in voting to move it forward, they have let us down.
Yeah, for the interstate bridge replacement, the recent vote at City Council, which me and Ada attended, basically every elected official expressed some form of concern about the project, whether about the height of it or the amount of lanes or the impact on the environment or public transportation. Yet all of them continued to vote yes. And one thing that Ada says a lot is in reference to like is an analogy to high school, which is like kind of following the status quo and listening to the bigger, more popular governmental agencies instead of really being true to what is right and what will help us in the future. And that just something that just sticks with me is our elected officials really aren't fighting for what is right, and they are really just following the status quo.
Tying it back a little bit to the recent vote with the interstate bridge replacement, I think that the fact that the vast majority, like every single elected official except for one, voted to move forward with the project but expressed concern is to me basically them saying, we know this project is bad. We've heard your testimony and we understand it's bad, but we don't have the courage to stand up against it. And so I think that that can be seen a couple of different ways. It's like, we need people in power who are brave enough to fight the status quo, but it also means that they have it in their heads that maybe what is happening is wrong. And so we know that even if our leaders don't have the courage, organizers have the courage to really fight to make our leaders understand that they need to stand up for us. And so in the next few months, it's really going to be about showing the people in power that people, that our communities care about these issues and that we need them to take action. And so we encourage you, anyone who's listening, to show up with us. Youth from Sunrise have been protesting these freeway expansion projects every other week for over a year. You can follow us on social media at Youth versus ODOT or find us on the Sunrise PDX website for information.
Liam, do you want to conclude with a thought or two about what sustains you and what you see ahead?
I think for me, organizing around freeways is one of those things I didn't expect to be doing even just a year ago. Because it's not, it really, you know, I was saying this earlier, it's really not something that people connect with climate change. And I want to be part of the movement that is changing that dialogue, where we can really see and look at the facts, like where are our emissions coming from and what can we do about it right now? And as Ada and Calliope were saying, you know, if our leaders can't stand up, or as you said, right, we're going to get in their faces. And beyond that, as a friend of mine who's on that group said a few months ago, right, we're getting older and we're about to be at the age where we can get elected. And if they can't stand up to if politicians can't stand up to, you know, to the bully agency, then we're going to take their places.
I certainly hope to have you on the show again. There are developmental aspects of life as people mature and enter adulthood, but there are developmental aspects of social movements too. And I think how we sustain a struggle and deepen and expand it over time is something we're interested in following on the Old Mole. So we hope to have you all back again, and we'll see you soon. Thanks so much, including for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That was Jan Hawken with Sunrise organizers Ada Crandall, Calliope Ruskin, and Liam Castles. I'd like to introduce Another World Is Possible with a bit more music from Buena Fe, the Cuban group that was just this past week performing in Venezuela. I'd like to bring them here. From their song, La Fuerza de un País, The Strength of a Country. And then we'll segue right into Another World Is Possible on Cuba.
Científicos con talento, imagínate un momento, a mi gente sin bloqueo, sé de quién tuvo el mareo, hablando vaina y me asombro, y ahora se quieren poner un pinchazo en cada hombro.
Tomorrow, July 26th, is the Cuban national holiday. The day doesn't commemorate Cuban independence from Spain, nor is it the date in 1959 when the revolution triumphed and the dictator Batista was overthrown. Rather, it refers to the date in 1953 when the movement that overthrew Batista was launched, the Movimiento de 26 de Julio, the July 26th movement, with Fidel Castro and Che Guevara among its principals. This month, July, also marks the one-year anniversary of significant protests that took place against the revolutionary government that resulted from that successful overthrow. It's an appropriate time to assess the Cuban Revolution. Let's start with some ground rules and basic recognitions. First, here's a quote from an excellent recent essay by Michael Leibowitz in Monthly Review Online. I'll draw on Leibowitz's insights throughout this discussion.
No country has faced greater obstacles in trying to build a post-capitalist society than Cuba. Criminal blockades, sanctions, invasions, imperialist terrorism, externally supported internal subversion, the loss of lifelines, natural disasters such as hurricanes and drought, and still, Cuba persists, as does some of the marvelous solidarity that marked its early years. But, like every society in the interregnum between capitalism and community, Cuba has been, and continues to be, characterized by what Fidel called the struggle to the death between the future and the past.
Recognizing what Cuba's been up against, nevertheless, its former ambassador to Venezuela has said, most citizens understand that the long-standing blockade, Donald Trump's draconian measures that exacerbated it, and the pandemic are essential causes of the serious problems we suffer. But many of us also agree that they are not the only ones. The opinion prevails among the people that we must focus on changing and improving everything that is within the country's reach, and not turning such realities of foreign origin into pretexts to justify deficiencies and endogenous errors. By endogenous errors, of course, he means errors made by the revolutionary leadership itself. Here in the U.S., our responsibility vis-à-vis Cuba is to oppose the blockade, the U.S.-generated invasions, the distorted and propagandistic media coverage, etc. But if we think of ourselves as part of an international movement, and we're not going to get anywhere unless we do, it's also important to be aware of the choices made by movements and countries attempting fundamental social transformation, the dilemmas they face, and the mistakes they make. So who are we, with our fragmented and unconvincing movement in this country, to comment on anyone else's mistakes? If we're to learn from their efforts, as we attempt to do here on The Old Mole and Another World Is Possible, if we're to take inspiration from their struggles and their choices, we have to attempt to evaluate them. Not attempting that would be falling into the same trap parts of the U.S. left have fallen into repeatedly over the past century, treating some movement or country as the fount of all revolutionary wisdom, whether it was the Soviet Union, China, Albania, for God's sake, or Cuba. There are at least two legitimate bases for being thoughtfully critical, while, of course, staying supportive. The first of those is to acknowledge the self-criticisms from within the Cuban revolutionary leadership itself. The second is to draw on what we know about how change happens. As we look at the difficult choices facing Cuba now, and as we think back to the protests of a year ago, here are some typically thoughtful reflections by Fidel Castro toward his last years in leadership.
Here is a conclusion I've come to after many years. Among all the errors we may have committed, the greatest of them all was that we believed that someone really knew something about socialism, or that someone actually knew how to build socialism. It seemed to be a sure fact, as well known as the electrical system conceived by those who thought they were experts in electrical systems. Whenever they said, "That's the formula," we thought they knew, just as if someone is a physician. You are not going to debate anemia or intestinal problems or any other condition with a physician. Nobody argues with the physician. You can think that he is a good doctor or a bad one. You can follow his advice or not, but you won't argue with him.
That was Fidel Castro acknowledging in Cuba the same kind of mistake the U.S. left has made repeatedly, being uncritical about decisions, policies, and perspectives of some other, seemingly more successful movement. In his case, he was talking about following the path of the former Soviet Union and how it distorted the development of Cuban socialism. As we'll see, Cuba faces difficult choices now and risks following another distorting example of supposed socialist expertise. Part of the tragedy is that Cuban leadership was aware of another path, admittedly one without precedent on a national scale, and rejected Che Guevara's cautions about the Soviet model. For more on what Che recommended as an alternative, look back into the Old Mole archives for February 28th of 2021, and the program on Che I did with Old Mole Luisa Martinez. Che was talking about Cuba, to be sure, but also about the kind of genuinely democratic change we want to see everywhere. Che's neglected ideas on social change bring us to that second legitimate basis for supportive criticism, what we know from centuries of experience about how change happens, how people gain a new and enhanced sense of their own capabilities to understand the world and to join with others to transform it. If you're a regular listener to these episodes of Another World is Possible, you know that's a theme we explore regularly from many sides. In his essay I mentioned earlier, Leibowitz quotes Marta Harnacker, outstanding Latin American revolutionary journalist, raising criteria for how to evaluate revolutionary governments. Here's what she said.
Do the governments mobilize workers and the people in general to carry out certain measures? And are they contributing to an increase in the people's ability and power? Do they understand the need for an organized, politicized people able to exercise the necessary pressure that can weaken the state apparatus and power they inherited, and thus drive forward the proposed transformation process? Do they understand that our people must be protagonists and not supporting actors? Do they listen to the people and let them speak? Do they understand that they can rely on the people to fight the errors and deviations that come up along the way? Do they give the people resources and call on them to exercise social control over the process? To sum up, is the government contributing to the creation of a popular subject who is increasingly the protagonist, one who is assuming governmental responsibilities?
How does Cuba stand up to those criteria? And more importantly than any evaluation by us, how does a revolution transmit its revolutionary spirit to subsequent generations? If people aren't increasingly mobilized as the decision makers, if they're left as supporting actors, if the vision of socialism is for the state to do things on their behalf instead of increasingly equipping them to take over the functions of the state, that participatory elan, that revolutionary spirit, diminishes over time. Which brings us to last year's protests. Again, our starting point for understanding them has to be the illegal U.S. blockade. Without it, Cubans wouldn't face the electricity blackouts, the inability to get medicines from abroad, the shortages of food, the long lines to buy scarce necessities. But the blockade and provocation from abroad are insufficient explanations for the protests. How the revolutionary leadership has chosen to respond to those shortages, blackouts, etc., has exacerbated the difficult conditions for part of the population. Specifically, turning to market mechanisms has not only deepened the inequalities in Cuban society, it has undercut the development of socialist consciousness and revolutionary commitment. Again, that leadership faces difficult decisions, and we're not in a position to say what they should or shouldn't do, but what we can do is identify and even predict the consequences of their decisions. Cuba has pioneered innovative programs to address its social and economic problems. For instance, the recent schools to train thousands of new social workers. We must recognize, though, that those idealistic young social workers are a response to ameliorate the growing inequalities, the lessening social security net, the unemployment, growing poverty, the neglected elders that result from introducing market mechanisms. Turning to capitalist market mechanisms to stabilize its currency, to husband its resources, has meant laying people off. It's meant greater concessions to foreign investment and foreign ownership of Cuban enterprises. It's meant closing communal and workplace eating places, closing entire state-owned enterprises if they can't make a profit in capitalist terms. The results have been predictable in ways we're familiar with in our own capitalist society. Rising prices, corruption, gangsterism, greater social stratification. And in Cuba, as in the U.S., that social stratification takes a racial form. As one Cuban commentator has written, because blacks and mulattoes are overrepresented in that poverty line, they are overrepresented in the worst indicators, the lowest income, poverty, homelessness, the worst jobs, etc. Therefore, there are objective tendencies for the issue of raciality to become a socialist problem for us and a base for the enemy on which he is acting with great energy. End quote. To assess the Cuban Revolution now, in 2022, one day short of its national holiday, is to offer a tale of caution. Michael Leibowitz, in the essay I've cited, reports that Cuban economists are enamored of Chinese and Vietnamese approaches of what they call market socialism. As we look at the possibilities for a better way of organizing our societies, as we advocate that another world is possible, I will suggest that market socialism is an oxymoron, that market-oriented reforms undercut the possibilities for socialism and the ability to maintain revolutionary involvement and revolutionary momentum on the part of the population. Cuba has been an extraordinary place, an experiment for all of humanity. Let's hope it avoids the long slide back to capitalism under whatever name and continues to be a revolutionary inspiration. This is Norm Diamond with one more exploration of another world that is possible. Reinforcing that conviction, the other voice you heard was Patricia Kohlberg, reading from Michael Leibowitz, Fidel Castro, and Marta Harnacker. And that is today's Old Mole. Thanks to Old Moles Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, Patricia Kohlberg, and John Nelson, to our guests Gerald Epstein, Ada Crandall, Calliope Ruskin, and Liam Castles, and to the dedicated staff at KABU who keep us going. Remember the Medicare for All rally this coming Saturday. The Old Mole Variety Hour is on every Monday morning at 9 o'clock. Till next week, this is Norm Diamond. Stay safe and stay active. Let's go out with a bit more of Silvio Rodriguez.
Con serpientes de mar, con cierto mar hay de serpientes, sueño yo. Largas, transparentes, y en sus barrigas llevan lo que puedan arrebatarle al amor.